the King and the Strange God. The 430 years of national retribution being ended, and with it the prophecy concerning Israel and the king of the northern horn of the Macedonian goat, a new power is introduced as superseding that of the northern king. This power appeared on the territory of the north and absorbed its dominion into itself, so that it became all in all. In the vision of the evening and the morning, Daniel chapter 8, it is represented by a little horn standing upon another horn, and is styled a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences. Moses describes the same power in these words, saying to Israel, "The Lord shall bring a nation against thee from far, from the end of the earth, swift as the eagle flieth, a nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, and he shall besiege thee in all thy gates. His power shall be mighty," said Gabriel, "but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, or by his power. And he shall magnify himself in his heart, and in prospering shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand." This is a general description of the power which should rule over the Assyro-Macedonian territory as well as over the Greco-Egyptian when their kingdom should come to an end for a time, that is, until their revival in the time of the end. I am particularly desirous that this part of the prophecy should be understood. Perhaps what I mean may be better comprehended by the following homely illustration. Suppose we were to take a goat's horn, and with a fret saw were to cut out a small piece of its surface, then fix this piece upon a spring, the lower end of which should be fixed inside the horn itself. Now, if pressure be applied to the small piece, it would be brought down to a level with the general surface of the horn. In this state, the horn would represent the Assyro-Macedonian kingdom under the Seleucidae. But remove the pressure, and the small piece of the horn would start up to the height of the spring's length. Let this represent the little horn upon the goat's horn, and we have the symbol of the power which prevails from the conquest of Assyro-Macedonia, 65 BC, until the time of the end. But if pressure be afterwards applied to the small piece, it is brought down to a level with the surface of the horn, and it again appears like one horn, for by the pressure the little horn is merged into it. This last action, and its result, will represent the merging of the little horn power of Constantinople into the Assyro-Macedonian or Russian horn of the goat in the time of the end, so that the Constantinopolitan and Russo-Assyrian powers become one horn as before the little horn arose. In the time of the end, the horn of the north, in its enmity against Israel, plays a similar part to that it did of old by the hand of Antiochus Epiphanes in the days of Judas Maccabeus. Therefore, he may be fairly taken as the type of Israel's last and greatest enemy, who shall come to his end with none to help him. This little horn power, or king of fierce countenance, is in the 36th verse of the 11th chapter styled the king who doeth according to his will. This federal potentate must be studied in his secular and ecclesiastical characters. His secular, with a hint or two of his spiritual character, is given in the 8th chapter, whilst his ecclesiastical is exhibited more fully in the 11th, from the 36th to the 39th verses inclusive. His policy was to be of a remarkable description, for through his policy he shall cause craft to prosper by his power. Hence his doings with regard to another and that person's words and deeds are all affirmed of this willful king, for it is by his power as well as through his policy that this person is enabled to do. Thus, putting them both together, for they are one in policy and action, the power is thus outlined by the prophet, who says, "And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, or ruler, and shall speak marvellous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that that is determined shall be done. He shall disregard all the gods of his fathers, and the desire of wives, nor shall he regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. This is evidently not descriptive of the pagan Roman power, but of that power invested with a new ecclesiastical character. In other words, it is descriptive of the imperial Constantinopolitan Catholic power. Of all who swayed this sceptre, from Constantine, the founder of the city, to Palaeologus, who lost it to the Turks, the Emperor Justinian is the best illustration of the willful king in his secular aspect. "Never, prince," says Dupin, "did meddle so much with what concerns the affairs of the church, nor make so many constitutions and laws upon this subject. He was persuaded that it was the duty of an emperor, and for the good of the state, to have a particular care of the church, to defend its faith, to regulate external discipline, and to employ the civil laws and the temporal power to preserve it in order and peace." Justinian, says Gibbon, sympathized with his subjects in their superstitious reverence for living and departed saints. His code, more especially his novels, confirm and enlarge the privileges of the clergy, and in every dispute between the monks and the laymen, the partial judge was inclined to pronounce that truth and innocence were always on the side of the church. In his public and private devotions, he was assiduous and exemplary. His prayers, vigils, and fasts displayed the austere penance of a monk. His fancy was amused by the hope or belief of personal inspiration. He had secured the patronage of the Virgin and St. Michael the Archangel, and his recovery from a dangerous disease was ascribed to the miraculous succour of the holy martyrs Cosmas and Damian. Among the titles of imperial greatness, the name of Pius was most pleasing to his ear. To promote the temporal and spiritual interest of the Greco-Roman Church was the serious business of his life, and the duty of father of his country was often sacrificed to that of defender of the faith. While the barbarians invaded the provinces, while the victorious legions marched under the banners of Belisarius and Narses, the successor of Trajan, unknown to the camp, was content to vanquish at the head of a synod. The reign of Justinian was a uniform yet various scene of persecution, and he appears to have surpassed his indolent predecessors, both in the contrivance of his laws and the rigour of their execution. The insufficient term of 3 months was assigned for the conversion or exile of all heretics, and if he still connived at their precarious stay, they were deprived under his iron yoke not only of the benefits of society, but of the common birthright of men and Christians. That's the end of the rather long quotation from Gibbon on Justinian. Antiochus Epiphanes and Justinian represent the king, as he will be manifested when, as the king of the north, he appears upon the arena, standing up to contend with the prince of princes on the field of Armageddon, for he is to prosper till the indignation be accomplished against Israel. Impious and cruel as Antiochus, and superstitious and fanatical as Justinian, with the arrogance, ambition, and profanity of the Roman bishop in his Halicean days, this incarnation of the sin power in the crisis of its fate will fully answer to all that has been predicated of the king who does according to his will, and for whom Tophet is ordained of old. At present he is represented by the sultan, who divides the land for gain. But when the little horn sceptre is wrested from his feeble grasp by the autocrat, we shall see him, a potentate unrivalled in presumption and impiety by any of his fathers, not exceeding Pharaoh of the olden time. In times past, the little horn of the goat has admirably illustrated the prophecy concerning him. Through his policy he shall cause craft to prosper by his power. In studying the reign of Justinian, this is remarkably apparent. But before the horn could find scope for the promotion of the species of craft referred to, it was necessary that he should disregard all the gods of his fathers. That is, embrace some other religion than paganism. In other words, become a Greco-Roman Catholic, such as Justinian, who occupied the throne but did not inherit the peculiar superstition of the Caesars. Having discarded the gods of his fathers, it suited the Horn's policy to bestow his patronage upon another, who should be a god upon the earth, and residing in Rome instead of above the heights of Olympus. The testimony of Daniel is that in his estate he shall honour the god of forces, or more intelligibly, in his kingdom shall he do honour to a god of guardians. The word rendered guardians is mahuzim, and signifies munitions. Hence any real or supposed persons adopted as protectors, guardians or patrons are mahuzim, or munitions of strength and safety. Now the god whom the little horn of the goat honoured in his kingdom was a god of guardian saints, who are regarded by his worshippers as protectors and towers of strength and security against all the ills that flesh is heir to. Such a god is the Bishop of Rome, who to the pagan officials of the Little Horn was unknown, being in their reign only a simple bishop, undistinguished from the rest of his class, save that he flourished in the capital and they in the provinces of the empire. He is therefore styled in the scripture a god whom his, the Little Horn's, fathers knew not. Hence he is also termed a strange god. But though strange and unknown to Trajan and the Antonines, he was afterwards brought into notice by Constantine and his successors. In AD 313 he was made chief magistrate of Rome, or as we should say, Lord Mayor for life. His jurisdiction was confined to the city. In 378, however, the Little Horn of the Goat, then reigning over the east and west, extended his spiritual authority over all the churches of Italy and Gaul, and by the time of Justinian, he was prepared for presentation to the nations as spiritual head of the whole Roman habitable. He was the god of a new system of idolatry, whose images were the images of Mahuzim, or the ghosts of pretended saints and martyrs, the demigods or demons of the new Roman mythology. In a celebrated letter written by the Emperor Justinian to this god of patron saints, dated March 533, and which thenceforth became part and parcel of the civil law, he is recognized as the legal head of all the churches of the eastern and western provinces of the empire. "We suffer not," says the imperial writer, "anything that belongs to the state of the churches to be done without submitting it to your holiness, who art head of all the churches." In this way, the king, who did according to his will, acknowledged this strange god as of supreme spiritual authority in the most strongholds. The work of recognition thus far advanced by Justinian was perfected by the edict of the emperor Phocas, who began to reign in 603. He also wrote to the Roman bishop in 604 and acknowledged his spiritual supremacy. He was very liberal to the churches and allowed the Pantheon, a temple dedicated to all the gods by his fathers, to be turned into a church, or most stronghold, to all the saints. Phocas was a monster in crime, and therefore the better qualified for a patron of the Roman bishop, who hailed him as the pious avenger of the church. By this kind of flattery, a decree was obtained from him by Boniface III in 606, declaring the Roman god universal bishop. 2 years after, a pillar with a Greek gilt statue on the top of it was erected in Rome to the honour of Phocas. Thus was memorialised the fulfilment of the sure word of prophecy that the little horn of the goat should in his kingdom do honour to a god of guardian saints. When the Bishop of Rome was honoured as a god by the little horn of the goat, the other little horn had not yet made its appearance among the 10 horned kingdoms of the beast. There elapsed 266 years from the date of Justinian's letter and 193 from the decree of Phocas before this came to pass, for Charlemagne was not crowned emperor of the western third part of the Roman Empire till 800 AD. Upon this occasion, he also acknowledged and increased with glory the universal bishop as a god above every god of his dominions. Through his policy, he also caused craft to prosper by his power. Priestcraft gained an ascendancy in Europe, which it had never attained before the rise of the Germano-Roman Little Horn among the kingdoms of the West. By forming an alliance with the Accursed One, all the powers were cemented together by a bond far stronger than the sword. The emperors perceived this and shaped their policy accordingly. The influence of the popes in strengthening the imperial authority is shown in the following quotation. There was no general connection existing between the states of Europe till the Romans, in endeavouring to make themselves masters of the world, had the greatest part of the European states under their dominion. From that time, there necessarily existed a sort of connection between them, and this connection was strengthened by the famous decree of Caracalla, by the adoption of the Roman laws, and by the influence of the Catholic religion, which introduced itself insensibly into almost all the subdued states. After the destruction of the Empire of the West in 493, the hierarchical system naturally led the several papal states to consider themselves in ecclesiastical matters as unequal members of one great society. Besides the immoderate ascendancy of the Bishop of Rome had the address to obtain as the spiritual chief of the church, his consequent success in elevating the Germano-Roman emperor to the character of a temporal chief brought such an accession of authority to the latter that most of the nations of Europe showed for some ages so great a deference to the emperor that in many respects Europe seemed to form but one society, consisting of unequal members subject to one sovereign. End of quote. Thus then the Wicked One was manifested by the working of Satan, with all the power of the Little Horn of the Goat, and afterwards of the Little Horn of the West. Strange and unknown to the pagan emperors, he became a god to the willful king, and eyes and mouth to the Little Horn of the West, so that until the capture of Constantinople in 1453, he was in some sort a connecting link between the two imperial horns. The prophecy before us, however, not only foretells his recognition by the Roman power, but sets forth other particulars of a striking and interesting character.